This podcast is sponsored by the Joyce Foundation, which invests in public policies to advance racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region.
Welcome, everyone, back to the Mackinac Policy Conference podcast from Cranes Detroit Business. I'm Chad Livengood, Senior Editor at Cranes. We've had an exciting day already. There's been a lot of things going on. I had an early interview this morning at 6:50 a.m., bright and early, with Governor Gretchen Whitmer. And then Mike Lee interviewed Quentin Messer, the CEO of the MEDC. Our next guest here at the Cranes booth on Media Row is Brian Peters, CEO of the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, and Chris Mitchell, the chief lobbyist, or outgoing chief lobbyist, of Michigan Health and Hospital Association. Gentlemen, welcome to our podcast today.
Thank you so much, Chad. Good morning.
Good morning, Chad. Good to have you. Make sure your mic's on. It's flipped on there. Yep. Okay. All right. So tell us a little bit about, Brian, what's sort of the focus? This is our first Mackinac conference in person in 28 months now. What are you here focusing on this week with when you're talking to policymakers?
Well, Chad, this has been an extraordinary year and a half for our membership. Our hospitals, both large and small throughout the state of Michigan, as you know, have been on the front lines of the COVID pandemic. And a couple of numbers that I would share with you that I think are incredibly impactful. Our hospitals throughout the state have now treated and successfully discharged 140,000 Michiganders. Those are folks who've been admitted to the hospital. Our frontline caregivers are truly heroes. These are now folks who've been discharged, as I said, safe, healthy, back to their families. And similarly, we've now had 500,000 emergency department visits since the inception of the pandemic.
That are just COVID related.
Those are just COVID related. And again, these are folks who are not ultimately admitted. 500,000 Michiganders who came to the emergency department for treatment were discharged. And again, our focus this week is really on public policy and support for our member hospitals and health systems so that they can continue to be there for all of us, whether it's a COVID-19 related healthcare issue or whether it's any number of other significant healthcare issues that we'll continue to confront in the years going forward.
Chris, you work inside the Capitol day in, day out, and obviously public policy around COVID has been a big focus. The legislature has been, basically at war with the governor in many ways over who decides, these policies. Do you see any kind of clarity on, is this sort of war over mask mandates and such, or over the DHHS powers, is this over, or do you think it might continue to linger on here?
Well, I think that's a great question. If I look into my crystal ball, I think I see an election year coming up next year, and I imagine both sides will be at odds with each other on many items, and I think the continued dialogue around vaccinations, mask mandates, who is the one who gets to make all the decisions. I think all of that is going to be part of the conversation as time goes on.
What's the current stats you're seeing and your hospitals are seeing right now? I mean, when I look at the numbers, they look like they've kind of flattened a little bit. Mm-hmm. I also look at the number that your hospitals report to MDHHS of previous day emergency visits related to COVID, because that's ultimately people who aren't sick enough to be admitted, but they're still clogging up ERs right now, right?
Right. Absolutely. And in fact, right now we have approximately 1,500 inpatients who are in our hospitals with COVID-19. As you said, that's a number that has remained relatively flat now for the last several weeks. There's been a slight increase. And so we're very hopeful that despite the return to school, despite some other troubling trends in other states in recent weeks and months, We're hopeful that Michigan won't see a significant surge as we saw in previous iterations. Now, having said that, it is very clear that right now the number one concern confronting all of our hospitals is workforce sustainability. We have folks, not only frontline caregivers, but the folks throughout the hospital organization who are critical to making the operation function day after day. A number of those folks have left the business. They are significantly impacted by the stress that we see day after day, week after week. And so right now, whether it's a small hospital in a rural setting or whether it's a large urban system, we are hearing very clear concerns about workforce sustainability. The supply is not keeping up with demand for our caregivers.
Do we need to be, as a state, doing something proactive to, you know, we have this Futures for Frontliners scholarship now, trying to get folks who maybe worked in like what was considered frontline industries. They worked in the grocery store, and trying to get them to basically consider going to college and getting some type of new skills to for a new in-demand job. Do we need to take that another step and just start a scholarship for nurses? Or, I mean, do we need something to basically backfill what it seems like a flood of retirements and people right. just quitting and burning out?
Well, it's an excellent point, and I'll let Chris talk a bit about the public policy aspect. But I will tell you that really when you look at something like the nurse shortage, it predated the pandemic. And what was really driving it, and the nurse shortage can be used as a parallel to many other shortages within the healthcare space. But when you look at the situation, it's the double-edged sword of our aging population. So it's the baby boomers who are now aging into Medicare eligibility, and these are the high-end utilizers of healthcare services, so putting more pressure on the delivery system. And at the same time, many of those baby boomers who are coming into retirement age or recently have reached retirement age are nurses themselves or caregivers themselves. And so this double-edged sword has created a supply and demand issue that has only been exacerbated by the pandemic. Many of our caregivers who are on the fence about early retirement have actually made that decision perhaps earlier than they had initially planned. And so it's put incredible pressure on our staffing. But Chris, talk about the public policy aspects of this issue.
Yeah, certainly. I think when we talk about the staffing issue, as Brian outlined, it's a huge, huge problem for a huge issue for our membership right now. But Michigan is not unique to this issue. We are facing a workforce shortage across the country. And so from our perspective, we believe that we've got to start or continue having the conversations at both the state and the federal level about what are the things we can do to incentivize folks to go into the healthcare field. And also, let's not forget about the healthcare workers who stayed with us throughout the pandemic. Are we doing all the things we need to do to retain those individuals and give them the support, whether that's financially or through any other support means, to ensure that they want to come to work and they're staying healthy? So some of the conversations we're having are around, what are some of the regulatory, can we relax some of the regulatory rules to make it easier for folks to enter the healthcare space? Are there things in the regulations that were relaxed during the pandemic that we can do long term to ensure that we have folks who will come in and work? We've done a lot of work in and around allowing Canadian nurses to come to Michigan to work. Can we do the same thing with physicians? We're looking at the Nurse Licensure Compact, obviously, to make it easier for nurses to come immediately to Michigan to work. So a lot of work to be done, but we're having some meaningful conversations. And as you know, there's still a lot of money that was sent down from the feds that isn't yet to be allocated. And we're hopeful that we can use some of that funding to help us with some of these recruitment and retention strategies.
I mean, there's not just some money. There's $7 billion
yes,
of money.
Yes,
I mean,
there's a lot.
That's still a lot of money to do a lot of things yep. with. Are there some other areas or initiatives where you think the state ought to be investing in, particularly in like public health, as we've kind of noticed our systems of public health were not anywhere near ready for this catastrophe?
This podcast is sponsored by the Joyce Foundation, which invests in public policies to advance racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region.
Well, Chad, you touched on, I think, a very important lesson that we've all learned from the experience of the last 18 months. And you're correct. In some regions of the state, what we found is that the relationship between one of our member hospitals or health systems and the local public health department was outstanding. And there was great collaboration. It worked very well. It was seamless. But unfortunately, I would say that was almost the exception to the rule. In most cases, what we have heard is that, as you said, that relationship and the guardrails around that relationship, who's responsible for what, how do we come together in times of crisis, those were not well established. And I think it's an opportunity for improvement going forward, no question about it. I would also tell you, as we talk about this issue, we really believe that technology can be a force multiplier. It's another lesson learned, right? Patients who used virtual care, perhaps for the very first time, because as you recall, early in the pandemic, we were really discouraging folks from coming to the hospital setting unless they absolutely needed to, while we were trying to sort out the specifics around this emerging pandemic. And so the alternative there was to use virtual care. Well, guess what? A lot of folks used it, liked it, found that it was effective for many interactions. And now the question becomes, how do we build that and scale it up? Some of that will involve public policy. Some of that will involve investment in technology. But to your question about the workforce sustainability issue, I think, again, technology can play a key role here.
A week or two ago, Henry Ford Health Systems announced that they were reducing their beds by about 140 across their entire system, mostly in Detroit and Jackson. Do you have other members that are doing that right now because they can't staff the number of beds they're licensed for?
You touched on the absolute issue, and that is the shortage of staff. And early in the pandemic, when we were talking about a shortage of available hospital beds, the reality was it's easy to insert a new hospital bed into a physical space. Sure. The issue all along has been staffing. And while it was a concern early in the pandemic, it's become a crisis at this point in time. As you said, now we do have members who've already announced a decision. We know that there are others who are on the cusp of making a similar decision if, in fact, the pressure on their system continues to escalate as it has in recent days. And remember, these are not necessarily COVID patients that are putting pressure on the system. In many instances, these are folks who have pent up demand for healthcare because they've delayed seeking treatment for longer than they traditionally would have. Now they have a significant issue and they're coming into a hospital setting. It's what's driven emergency department volume increases in recent weeks. So we're very concerned about what the future holds in this regard.
Yeah. Chris, 28 months ago, the governor and the legislative leaders stood on this porch and the governor signed the auto insurance reform bill that, for the most simplest explanation, for most of your members, capped their provider rates at 200% of the Medicare billing rate for any given procedure for treating a car accident victim. How is that working out in your hospital level? This, I mean, I've been writing about the home health care companies and the rehab facilities that have taken a pretty big hit from their rate cut. But how's that playing out in hospitals?
Obviously, we're still very early on. I know it was 28 months ago, which the governor did sign that legislation. But as you know, the fee schedule that you mentioned went into effect July 1. And we've been working closely with our members, collecting information about their experiences and the changes. And what I can tell you now is that we are working very closely with DIFs. We still believe that even though the legislation passed, there's a lot of uncertainty on what that 200% means, what that includes in hospital standard payments. And I think what we're looking for here in the short term and the longer term is clarity and a better understanding on how this is going to impact hospitals and how much reduction in funding they're going to see, but it's still really early right now. I can tell you that.
I mean, there's north of 120 different auto insurance companies. Are they paying their bills? I mean, hearing from some of these providers, smaller providers, that they're not getting paid, or they haven't been through a billing cycle yet, or a couple billing cycles to really see what actually is going, how each insurer is interpreting this. Is that, have you heard anything about that yet?
I can certainly tell you anecdotally that we are hearing that they are indeed paying our members. We haven't heard a whole lot yet that they're refusing to pay any bills. What I also will tell you is hospitals, unlike smaller facilities, their billing cycles tend to lag a little bit longer than some of the smaller providers. So we don't really have a large data set to tell you.
Makes sense. Okay. Okay. And also, lastly, Chris, you're getting ready to leave MHA and head west.
Yes.
To be the head of the Iowa Health or Hospital Association. Talk a little bit about the new job and you're leaving Michigan and why.
So that's really a complicated question, but what
I always have a loaded question here. Yeah. But at the end.
So, you know, first and foremost, what I would say is, as you know, I've been with the Hospital Association just over 15 years, and it's been a wonderful experience for me. I started out as an administrative fellow, and now I'm the executive vice president of advocacy and public affairs, as well as the chief lobbyist. This is just a new and exciting opportunity for me. It's a new chapter in my life. I think I'm ready to spread my wings, for lack of a better word. This is always part of a larger plan for me. You know, I just finished certainly my MBA this spring. So this is sort of the next logical step for me.
You knocked out an MBA during the pandemic.
I did, but that's a total another interview, I'm sure. But obviously, Iowa Hospital Association, a lot of the same challenges that we're facing in Michigan.
Sure.
Particularly as it relates to rural healthcare, which we didn't talk a lot about today. But I imagine I'll be spending a lot of time talking about rural healthcare in the months ahead. And so, you know, I'm just going to be an advocate for the Iowa Hospital Association, hopefully half as effectively as I've been here, and really looking forward to it.
I mean, you've had to balance in your role in the legislature representing, you know, hospitals in Detroit and hospitals in Decatur or some rural area. Just talk briefly about some of the challenges in rural healthcare you see that really have emerged in the pandemic.
I think we touched on a number of them. I mean, as much as our more urban and city hospitals have been struggling with staffing, our rural members have been struggling with staffing, as Brian mentioned, much longer than that. And the pandemic has just continued to escalate that even further. You know, I think longer term, we're looking at things like being able to ensure that these hospitals stay open. And that was a big concern at the beginning of the pandemic, particularly as folks were shying away from the hospital because of the pandemic and they weren't getting the same sort of patients in and out to provide the services that they need. So I would say just general sustainability, staffing issues, you know, as well as payment issues. I mean, those are the big things that our rural hospitals are facing today.
Yeah, Chad, I would just mention a couple of things. One is that Chris clearly has done an outstanding job in his role here at MHA, and I couldn't be more excited for him to take on this new role in Iowa. And secondly, the reality is Chris and I are going to continue to work very closely together, because the Iowa Hospital Association, the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, will be in Washington, D.C. frequently collaborating on federal advocacy, because more and more, as you look to the future with our aging population, more people enrolled in the Medicare program, we are going to really depend on good public policy coming out of Washington, D.C., and that's where our respective associations are going to come together. So I look forward to continuing my work with Chris in the years ahead.
The issues in Detroit are relevant in Des Moines as well. So
Yes.
Absolutely.
All right. Chris Mitchell and Brian Peters, the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks a lot, Chad. Appreciate it.
I'm Chad Livengood, Senior Editor at Cranes Detroit Business, and you've been listening to our podcast from the Mackinac Policy Conference.
This podcast is sponsored by the Joyce Foundation, which invests in public policies to advance racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region.